Hello, it's Monday, April the 12th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, should video games be taught in schools? Kids seem to think so. Of course they do. At last, pubs are reopening. Well, some of them, those with gardens and restaurants with outside spaces. I'm going to be talking to my favourite publican, Tim Foster. We're also going to be talking about Prince Philip to his close friend Giles Brandreth, who can tell us what he really thinks about Harry going to the United States to live with Meghan. But first, Harry has arrived in London for the funeral. We'll get the latest on what's happening with Rebecca English, who is our royal editor. So leading members of the royal family have all expressed their sorrow at the death of Prince Philip as the Queen worshipped privately at Windsor Castle at the weekend, where Prince Philip's coffin is resting in a private chapel. Prince Harry has arrived back in the UK. He'll go into quarantine ahead of Saturday's funeral. His wife, the Duchess of Sussex, has stayed in the United States, doctors advising her not to travel because she's heavily pregnant. Joining me now to discuss this is the Daily Mail's royal editor, Rebecca English. Rebecca, what's the latest today?
Well, the latest today, literally just as I'm speaking to you, we are now getting some tributes coming out of Buckingham Palace from Prince Philip's grandchildren, and they've been led by the Duke of Cambridge on behalf of him and his wife, and he talks about his grandfather's century of life defined by service. He says he feels so lucky to have had his example to guide him. He will never forget the kindness he showed to his wife. He will never forget those special memories that his children have of their great-grandpa coming to collect them in their carriage. And actually, there's a wonderful picture that's been released, taken by the Duchess of Cambridge, of Prince George when he was two, sitting in a carriage with his great-grandfather.
How charming.
And he describes his grandfather as an extraordinary man, part of an extraordinary generation. And I think this is a real crucial line here. He says that Catherine and I will continue to do what he would have wanted and will support the Queen in the years ahead. I will miss my grandpa, but I know he would want to get us to get on with the job, which I think is quite poignant, and some people might say quite pointed.
Very pointed, isn't it? Because it's a complete counterbalance to what his brother has chosen to do with the rest of his life. Has Harry made any statement yet, Rebecca, apart from that very peculiar statement that they put out on Friday, which talked about duty and didn't even mention the fact he'd lost his grandpa?
Well, actually, as we speak, I'm expecting in the next 10 minutes to get something from the Sussexes. So we will hear from him today. Interestingly, I don't believe his statement will be given out by Buckingham Palace. It will be given out by his own spokesman. But it is being done with the knowledge and presumably the blessing of Buckingham Palace. And we may hear from some of the Prince Philip's other grandchildren during the course of the day.
And just finally, Rebecca, John Major was on the Mars show on Sunday. John Major is a wise old bird, the elder statesman of British politics. He was saying he really, really hopes that the rift between William and Harry, which is palpable and very public, that this week there may be some efforts to heal it. And I suspect that it might be easier to do that, Rebecca, bearing in mind the Duchess of Sussex isn't here. I'm not blaming her for the rift, but maybe just easier if the two brothers sit down eyeball to eyeball as great friends that they used to be.
I think that's what a lot of people are hoping. But don't forget, you know, Prince Harry is going to be in, he's here now, and he's going to be in quarantine to pretty much, you know, hours before the actual funeral. So I'm not sure how much time they will have to sit down beforehand. Obviously, the body language at the funeral is going to be fascinating. I think John Major's right. I think a lot of people hope that they will be able to use this as the start of the healing process. But interestingly, whose judgment and intellect on these things I value quite a lot, said to me at the weekend, don't underestimate how damaging what Harry and Meghan has done and the extent of this rift. And they predicted it could take decades or maybe even a lifetime to try and repair. So this might be the start of things, but I think there's a long way to go yet.
Very interesting. And just if history repeats itself, if you think about George VI and Edward VIII, Edward abdicated, the rift between the two brothers was never healed.
It's a really good point. And you know, its ramifications have stretched right down the generations as a result of that. So, I mean, let's hope that doesn't happen in this occasion. You know, they've been through a lot together,
yeah,
as brothers. But the hurt is there and the hurt is real.
All right, that's Rebecca English, the Royal Editor of the Daily Mail. So read her stuff in the paper tomorrow about the tributes from the Queen and Prince Philip's grandchildren. So why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The author and broadcaster Giles Brandreth has written a powerful and moving account of his close friend Prince Philip in today's Daily Mail. They've known each other for more than 40 years. He describes how the prince's ability to make the Queen laugh was vital to the success of their remarkable marriage, 73 years they were together, and his thoughts on Harry and Meghan's interview with Oprah, that no good would come of it. Giles joins me now. Giles, I was very struck when you wrote in your piece that Prince Philip said, "I'm coming to the end." He said that in February, but you said he often said that. But do you think he knew this time that it was different?
Yes, I mean, I think he'd been saying it, to be honest, for more than 20 years. I mean, about 20 years ago, at the time the Queen Mother turned 100, I asked him, I said, "You're looking forward to your own 100th birthday?" He said, "Good God, no, can't imagine anything worse." But he rather changed his tune over the years, and I think he thought in the end it would be quite nice to have actually clocked up a century. But he found it frustrating. As he said, pieces, bits of me keep dropping off. And he didn't like getting older. He was very proud of his fine physique. I don't think there's any other man I know who at the age of 99 was walking without a stick, ramrod back, kept himself fit, daily exercises, stretching exercises. But this time it was just too much for him. You know, he was an old man and he'd lived a long and good life. And I think this last visit in hospital was frustrating for him because he was a voracious reader. One of the pleasures of his retirement was being able to read. And he found he was tired and concentration was difficult. And there we are. So the end of an extraordinary story. What a privilege to have known such a remarkable man.
And he was desperate to get back to Windsor Castle to spend his last few days there. And of course, that meant he could be with the Queen.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we've been talking rightly over the last few days of what he gave to the Queen, she called him, you know, her strength and stay all these years. And also, you know, he made her laugh, which was a great gift to be able to have as a husband. But he got something from the Queen as well. He had this strange childhood where, as you know, he was living in exile in France until he was 10, and then his parents, their marriage broke up, and his mother ended up in an asylum for a while, and his father went down to the south of France, and he had a peripatetic childhood during his teen years. And his homes, really, until he married the Queen, his first home was being at boarding school. His next home was being in the Royal Navy. And he used, in those days, the late 1930s, in visitors' books, he put at his address, "No fixed abode." And it wasn't until he married the Queen in the 1940s, in 1947, that he found a home. She gave him, in a way, his first home since he'd been a child. And that, of course, meant everything to him. And those early days, when they lived at Clarence House, and then when he was in the Navy and serving in Malta, and they had really what, by royal standards, a very ordinary, you know, service officer's life in Malta. Those were good times. And I think he was always conscious of that. I asked him once, "How do you think you're viewed by the public?" And he said, refugee prince, I suppose. And I think he was conscious that, you know, he had come to this country from abroad. He, of course, was partly British. Both he and the Queen were great-great-grandchildren of Queen Victoria. But I think he was conscious of what the country gave him, and he was grateful for that. And though he was an outsider, he was an insider who was the outsider, and fascinating to observe him. But such an extraordinary man, and so multifaceted. That's the thing I've been thinking about. You know, there is so much to say about him that one should write a book. Well, fortunately, I have. Unfortunately,
and you have. And we're going to serialize it. Remind me, Giles, what the book is, the title of your new book is called, and when we're going to see it.
It's called Philip, the Final Portrait. And it comes out at the end of this month, in a couple of weeks from now. And it began really many years ago, 20 years ago, at around the time of his 80th birthday. He asked me to write a short biography of him for one of his charities, and I did it. And he seemed to approve, and it sort of sprung from that. But one of the disconcerting things about working on it, with showing him the proofs, etc., was that he kept correcting me. You know, not on the matters of opinion, but he was very keen on fact. He just said, you know, stick to the facts, keep the gossip out of it, stick to the facts if you wouldn't mind. And I made simple mistakes. I mean, for example, during the Second World War, he was in the Navy, and I put that he'd served on HMS Ramillies. And he said, I didn't serve on HMS Ramillies. I said, you did, sir. You know, you were mentioned in dispatches. You had a fine war record. You led me the logbooks. He said, I did not serve on HMS Ramillies. I said, you did, sir. You lent me the... He said, I didn't serve on HMS Ramillies. I served in HMS Ramillies. You don't live on your house, do you? You live in your house.
You're such a stickler. Yes, what a stickler.
What a detail.
Certainly was. Just briefly, you did report what his view on Meghan and Harry, his view that Harry, he liked Harry, thought Harry was a good guy, but no good would come of the Oprah Winfrey interview, which I think everybody can agree he was right on. But I think he was not necessarily critical of Harry deciding he wanted to do things his own way and moving to America with his wife.
Very much not. I mean, what is interesting about Prince Philip is, though he was in some ways old school, stiff upper lip, that generation, he was not judgmental. And I think he thought, well, you know, people do things in different ways. And, you know, he would have wished Harry the best of luck. But he did have as a rule, he did say this, I know, to his children. I imagine he said it to his grandchildren as well. If you give television interviews, talk about what you're doing. Talk about the projects that you're involved in. Don't talk about yourself. That really is madness. No good comes of it. Because once you start talking about yourself, the story then becomes about you. And that's not a good thing. I mean, he told me, he said, you won't remember this, but when the Queen became Queen, and I was alive, but I was a very little boy, he said, we went on a tour to Australia. This is, I think, the beginning of 1954. And he said, millions of people turned out. Millions. And we went in cars, and millions were there cheering the Queen. He said, if the Queen had taken it for herself, personally, it would have been corrosive, but she didn't. The Queen is the same with one person or a million people. It's not about you. It's about the role you're privileged to fulfill and the work that you're doing. Talk about that.
Fabulous. And we'll miss him. You'll miss him personally, Giles, because you were friends for more than four decades.
Well, you know, I was reminded of something that James Callaghan, the former Prime Minister, said. Royals, they offer you friendliness, not friendship. There is a difference. I wouldn't want to be presumptuous, but he showed me many acts of kindness, as a friend would. When I wanted to be an MP, for example, I had never been to see the state opening of Parliament. He said, you better come. And he got me in there and went as his guest. And then when I lost my seat, he phoned up and said, well, what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to go back to journalism. He said, oh, God almighty. He said, really? I said, yes. I said, will you give me an interview? He said, I suppose I better had. And that was really probably the only personal interview he'd ever given. And it led, in a way, to, you know, this book all these years later. So he was a remarkable man. And it was one of the great privileges of my life to know him. He was a proper role model.
Certainly was. That's Giles Brandreth in his book, Philip the Final Portrait, which is going to be serialised in the mail in a couple of weeks' time. Giles, a joy to talk to you as always. So drinkers are flocking back to pubs across England and Wales as thousands reopen for the first time in months, along with shops, restaurants and gyms. Boris Johnson has urged people to behave responsibly. But industry body UK Hospitality predicted that only a third of venues have enough outdoor space to make it worth reopening today. I'm joined now by Tim Foster, my favourite publican, who is, of course, the owner of Yummy Pubs. Tim, some of yours are open, but not all.
We are trading all four. We made the decision
Great.
Late, so we are trading them all. I'm in one of them, and I'm here with Valence and Witty, and we're smashing into teas and coffees. We're just waiting for you.
How is it going? Are you rammed?
Yes, rammed in a social distance and very controlled manner. So we've got 600 people booked in to the Wymeal over today. And just over 4,000 for the week. So, yeah, it started a little bit bleak this morning with a flurry of snow, and it didn't look like it was going to happen. But we have a terrace with lots of people. And the nicest thing is just we kind of went out at 9:30 with a slice of brownie and a candle in it, and the table started singing happy birthday, and a couple of other tables joined in. I must have heard the entire terrace in vocal song about 15 times singing happy birthday today. So it's been great.
How very nice. You know, Tim, I think if it had been a snowstorm, people were still going to go to the pub today because they are so desperate. They're so fed up with this wretched lockdown. It's gone on far too long and we miss our pubs.
Yeah, totally. We were a bit worried. We were concerned at first. We had a few cancellations for breakfast, understandably. You know, we've got the terrace, but the snow was literally, you couldn't even see the lake. Joe and I looked at each other just to go, you couldn't even make it up, but it's cleared now, the sun's out. We have some fantastic customers enjoying the pub and enjoying being out.
Good, great. And tell me, Tim, what about social distancing? How long do you think you have to get this has to continue for? Have you been given any guidance yet by the government, or are you making it up basically as you go along?
Yeah, we're making up as we go along, like we've had to do this whole time of the yo-yo effect of open-close. So it's guidance, it's best in class, and we're having to get everybody to sign into the NHS app and every individual doing that. So we're giving people a card and sitting them down so they're not having to queue at the door, because if you were to follow the guidance, then that's probably what they'd be asking you to do, and having people stand in massive queues. So we've taken that decision ourselves to change that. And listen, let's see if he sticks to the roadmap. That's what we need him to do. Yes, I'm trading. Yes, I've got people here, but we're not making money. You know, we've taken on a massive burden of debt, as you well know. We've spoken about loads. So we need to be trading properly, and we need to have these restrictions removed. And, you know, let's keep going. Let's have the deaths coming down and the vaccination rollout, and aim for that 21st of June date where everything gets released and we are all back to the land of the living and not having to follow some of these ridiculous rules that you and I have spoken about on many occasions.
Yeah. What I can tell you, Tim, from my spies in the government, there's absolutely full steam ahead for the complete lifting of lockdown by the middle of June.
And I'll take that as a cast guarantee if that's from you, for sure.
Definitely. In the same way, I knew there was going to be an extension to the stamp duty thing and the budget and various things. The Prime Minister's political future is bleak if there's any watering down of the rules. And the rollout of the vaccine, Tim, has been successful. Have you had your vaccine yet? Or are you too young?
No, still too young, I'm afraid. But I will be having it done. I think, you know, we can't take it away from them. Bringing in the army and the logistics, and just it's world class. It's been phenomenal to watch, and it's something that they've 100% got right. So we can't take that away from anything at all. You know, we can look at what they've done with other stuff, but it's just been great. My mum's had her; she's happy. I helped her move house and to a new flat the other day. So, you know, and we've had people here today that are just meeting each other for the first time in months and months and months.
How
and
nice!
Crying and
thinking. Oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant.
Well, look, Tim, we're thrilled for you. We'll keep in touch with you. We'll let you get back to your throng, and I hope to see you there myself in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, definitely. I will take you up on that. Thanks for everything.
All right, look after yourself, Tim. That's Tim Foster, the owner of Yummy Pubs. It's sports time. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood here to give me my daily tutorial on things I know nothing about. But I do know it's the first Japanese golfer to win the Masters in the United States. Haven't a clue how to pronounce that name, though, Matt.
Matsuyama. You're right.
Right.
And he is the first Japanese golfer. So a massive moment. In fact, we talked before the tournament about the domination of the Americans in the Masters, in all golf majors, really, over recent over the last sort of few years. And so it was good to get an international winner and good to get Japan's first. And he obviously made his move on Saturday night and had a 4-shot lead going into the final round on Sunday. He actually didn't play particularly well on the final round, or not towards the latter stages. It looked like he might throw it away. Obviously, you know, the nerves of that back nine on Augusta on a Sunday afternoon, people talk about that. And it obviously played a part as he wobbled, but he just got home. There was one moment that his nearest challenger for a while was a guy called Xander Schauffele, who's an American, wonderful name. And he was getting close. He was, you know, only a shot behind. And then on the 16th, he put his ball into the water, and that put an end to him. So it was clear for Matsuyama to take it home. He only won by one shot in the end. But the English challenger, Justin Rose, who was leading after the first day, sadly fell away over the weekend as well, and finished 5 shots back in the end. So the wait goes on for an English winner, but some will say it's good that it wasn't an American winner.
Absolutely right. Now, Tottenham Hotspur, you won't mind this because you're an Arsenal fan, so I presume that means you don't like Tottenham. They lost at home to Manchester United. Is it possible, Matt, that it could all be turned on its head again, the Premier League, and that Manchester City, who lost on Saturday at home to Leeds, most unexpected, and Manchester United won well, could they overtake them?
I don't think they can. I think the gap's too big. It's still a decent-sized gap at the top. I think it's 9 points if Man U win their game in hand. So I think it's still too much. I think City have, you know, they've got enough. They rested 7 players, Man City, on Saturday because they've still got their second leg of their Champions League game coming up next week. So I think they'll be fine. I think Man U, you know, valiant effort, but I don't think they'll have enough. But yeah, it was an interesting game yesterday between Tottenham and Man U, which then turned into, as ever with Jose Mourinho, an unseemly war of words between the two managers. So wherever there's Jose, there seems to be anger and confrontation. And he was appalled that. So what happened yesterday? The Tottenham player Heung-min Son went down, holding his face, rolling around after he'd been caught by a Manchester United player. Manchester United went on to score in that move, but then the goal was cancelled because of the foul. But Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the Manchester United manager, was fuming at the theatrics, as he saw it, of the guy rolling around on the floor. Said, if that had been my son, I wouldn't have fed him that night. Which incensed Jose Mourinho. I know, great line.
What's his Oliver Twist?
I know.
You'd spend the night in the workhouse.
Indeed, he would have done. So, and that incensed Jose Mourinho, who, you know, was appalled that one of his players would be accused of cheating, basically, and trying to con the referee, as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had it. So wherever Jose goes, there seems to be anger and there seems to be arguments. And also that defeat, really, I think now, could well spell the end of his time at Tottenham, because it now looks like they're not going to finish in the top four, which we think is the minimum requirement for him to keep his job. So he could be looking for his next job pretty soon.
I don't know why anybody would give him a job. He always fails these days.
Well, you're right. And he doesn't just fail. He also turns the club toxic on his way out. So you're right. I think it'll be international management for him next. I really do. I think you're right. I don't think there's another club side who would go near him. You know, some clubs would, but I don't think the clubs that would go near him, I'm not sure he'd go near them. So it will be interesting what his next move is, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's into international management.
Very interesting. And just finally, West Ham beat Leicester, so they're pushing for a top four place as well.
Well, this is the amazing story of the season as it unfolds, is that West Ham, who, you know, everyone sort of thought would be certainly the bottom end of the table when the season began, and now looking more and more like they will finish in the top four and they will play Champions League football next season. They beat Leicester 3-2 yesterday, so they're back into the top four as it stands now. And it's been quite remarkable. And the guy who's leading this charge is a guy called Jesse Lingard, who they've got on loan from Man U. Moyes, the manager of West Ham, used to be the manager of Man U, so he knows this player. Got him on loan in January, and he's been a sensation. He scored 8 goals in 9 games, 3 assists, and he's putting himself firmly in the reckoning to be in the England squad for the Euros. And the unthinkable might happen, that West Ham may finish in the top four and have Champions League football. You know, it's great that that a club beyond the kind of traditional big six may be making a charge into the top four, and West Ham are doing it. They've got an easy fixture, few fixtures before the end of the season, so I wouldn't bet against them.
Okay, easy fixture coming up, must be playing your team, Arsenal.
They probably are, yeah, you're right. No, they're not actually. They've already beaten us and drawn with us this season, so they've got us out.
All right. Hope you didn't mind me teasing you. That's Matt Gatwood, who's always a great sport, if you pardon the pun, deputy sports editor at the Daily Mail. So should video games be taught in schools like literature in films? Children certainly seem to think so, with a recent poll by gaming company HyperX finding 52% of children think gaming should be part of the school curriculum. 55% believe gaming is a way into a future career, such as being a professional gamer. It's all beyond me, I'm afraid. I'm joined now by Dr. Dieter de Klerk, who's a lecturer in film and media studies at the University of Kent. Dr. de Klerk, the kids like the idea, but their parents are nothing like as keen. I think barely a quarter of parents think this is the sort of thing that should be on the school curriculum. What's your view?
I think that's really quite interesting. It might have something to do with the status that video games have in our society. Perhaps video games aren't as well understood as they should be, and maybe that's exactly a reason why it would be good for children to learn to think critically about them as well. And what's particularly interesting about that, also in our research that we did find out that actually most parents say that they game at least occasionally. So there seems to be a kind of dissonance between, you know, what parents themselves engage in, find gaming interesting to do, and then have some doubts about whether it would be good for children to engage with in a school setting.
Why would it be good for children to engage with it in a school setting? Because don't we want to encourage children to do less gaming because we want to get them more into books? And or am I just being terribly frumpy and old-fashioned?
I mean, I think that's an interesting contrary. I think, you know, video games tell stories just in the way that books tell stories. So perhaps we shouldn't necessarily pitch them. You know, I don't think we should pitch books against video games. I think, you know, children, young people should have a rich media education. Video gaming, such a booming industry. And during the pandemic, we've heard lots of good, interesting things about video games, how they are, for example, good for children's mental health or for socializing. These are also questions that we ask in our research, and parents also often readily acknowledge that, yes, you know, because they stayed in touch with their friends, you know, via online multiplayer games, my children were actually able to cope better during the pandemic. So I don't think it needs to be an either or conversation, but I do think that video gaming is such an important growing booming industry that in order to develop, you know, media critical children, that it is important to for them to engage with it. Yes.
And if it did, if it was to go into the classroom, would it be, what age would they be in your view? Would it be primary school, senior school? Would people be able to sit a GCSE in gaming, or an A level maybe, or even later in life go on and study it at university?
I mean, to be honest, I'm coming at this from the perspective of you know, somebody in media studies. I think I'm not a specialist on how the curriculum should be developed. What I do want to say is that there are, for example, existing initiatives already. Digital Schoolhouse, for example, is an initiative where some gaming companies have worked together with educators, and they are using video gaming, for example, as a way of getting people into STEM subjects. And like you say, you refer to children reading books. It could also be something that is integrated like that. And also, like, games are really quite interesting artifacts where we are actively doing things. We're often solving problems. I think games for that reason is also, that's also something that kids themselves in our research have acknowledged, that they think from their own experience, you know, it helps me develop certain kinds of skills such as problem solving, even multitasking. So it's definitely, I think, worthwhile to listen to young people themselves and why they think gaming is valuable.
There's talk too, isn't there, Doctor, of young people pursuing career opportunities through gaming, such as things like marketing, voiceovers, voice acting, game design, sound engineering. Yeah. Good, strong, positive career options.
Oh, absolutely. And here I think esports, as again a booming industry, can be really interesting. So our research also, you know, we asked children, would you want to be involved in esports competition if they were organized by your school or your college, which would mean that, of course, these events would be regulated with teachers. And over half of the children responded that they would be. And we also asked them, had you already been part of such an event? Because, for example, the British Esports Association hosts these kind of esports competitions at a grassroots level through colleges and schools. And only 10% had already participated, but you know, more than half wanted to participate if the option was there. And I do think that, to me, it feels like, you know, what is the value of grassroots football, for example? To some extent, it is to get people at the highest competitive level, but lots of people, young people, but you know, amateur footballs, they engage in team sports because it offers them all sorts of great skills, right? And I feel that esports can also be a way for people to, you know, be part of team sport, for example, if they're not necessarily that interested in traditional sports, or for example, if they have a particular kind of disability that prevents them from participating in these sports. And in the same way that, you know, the football industry, just to give you one example, I mean, there are many more jobs in the football industry than just becoming, you know, a pro at Manchester City, for example. You know, these are big companies that, like you say, somebody needs to market it. You know, there are physical coaches. Obviously, games need to be designed and developed. There's an artistic side to that. There's a computing side to that. And, you know, it is a media industry which is growing. And, you know, you also asked me, like, you know, why should children also engage with video games and, you know, alongside traditional media like literature? Well, just because, you know, video gaming, you know, we all game on our mobile phones, you know, it's all growing. It's going to remain a part of our lives for the foreseeable future. And, you know, I think there's great economic growth. So lots of very positive jobs there.
And just finally, I see that in the research with HyperX that 86% of parents say they play video games. To you, Doctor.
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, and...
What's your favourite?
Well, this is a video game called The Last of Us and The Last of Us 2, which is really interesting when you were talking to me about, you know, shouldn't children be reading books? This kind of video game, it tells a really rather complex story, and actually you're forced to sometimes make choices in these games that you might not necessarily want to make yourself, but it helps you to reflect on rather really complex issues. And actually, I teach a module at the University of Kent, you know, with students as part of our media studies program. And we've got a video gaming module, and we play games. We think critically about games, for example, you know, whether they are good for our social lives, whether they, you know, can make us smarter. And in the same way, I think I read books, I play football, but I also play video games. And I do think that, you know, video games definitely have a part in our lives.
Fascinating. That's Dr. Dieter de Klerk, who's lecturer in film and media studies at the University of Kent. Thanks for joining us. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.